On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The violence in Syria is unrelenting and largely unreported, but a few Western journalists have gone in to get the story out.
When rebel fighters tried to overrun a Syrian army checkpoint, four men were killed, several others were injured.
That voice was CBS News correspondent Clarissa Ward earlier this month, traveling secretly with rebel fighters inside Syria, free from government minders and at the risk on the front lines. This hour on Point, a reporter back from the front lines of Syria. And you can join the conversation. Have you been watching the reports coming out of Syria? Should the West get involved? Should the United States? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward. She recently returned from a reporting trip deep into one of the rebel-controlled towns in Syria. Clarissa Ward, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us geographically, where is this uprising taking place?
Well, it's taking place across the entire country, from the cities of Daraa to the southeast and the city of Homs, all the way stretching up to the north to the city of Idlib, where we were just near the Turkish border. There are pockets of this uprising throughout the entire country, even in the city of Aleppo, which up until recently had been largely free of the uprising. So really, this is throughout the entire country.
And what of Damascus? I'm hearing some reports of unrest on the fringes of that city, but not in the main squares.
I was in Damascus in late November, also unbeknownst to the government. I actually went in on a tourism visa, and already by late November, the suburbs of Damascus had become a hotbed of the uprising. There were rallies taking place almost daily, funerals unfortunately taking place almost as frequently. So, yes, the suburbs of Damascus very much involved with this uprising.
Is there coordination between the rebel groups? How would you characterize the uprising?
I think this is the great difficulty that oppositionists in Syria face at the moment, is that there is not a clear and coherent leadership to the opposition or to these armed rebel fighters. We were staying with a group in Idlib in the north of the country just the week before last, who called themselves the Syrian Liberation Army. They see themselves as a distinct entity from the better known Free Syrian Army. And it just gives you a sense of the idea that there are so many armed rebel gangs out there, all of them with, you know, very high-minded ideas about what they want from this revolution. But there are only loose affiliations between all these different groups. And so the end result is something of a chaotic effect, whereby you have all these different bands of fighters with no real unified sense of how they are going to go about achieving their goals.
And Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, says these are no more than gangs. And to some extent, the rebels say, yes, we are gangs. That's all we can be at this point.
Yes, I think that President Assad is trying to marginalize the opposition by dismissing them as gangs of terrorists, as he likes to call them, or thugs. There is a large faction of rebel fighters who have defected from the military, who were soldiers with Syria's armed forces and are now fighting against them. But there's no question that in a lot of the northern provinces, particularly, many of these fighters are farmers and workers. They don't have military training. They don't have sophisticated weaponry. They're not particularly well organized as military units. And that is a great hindrance to them. On the other hand, what can one expect? They don't have any formal outside support, whether it be in terms of money or weapons.
Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook on Point, speaking with Clarissa Ward of CBS News. President Assad also made a televised speech last summer, which he said conspiracies are like germs which increase every moment and in every place. It is impossible to exterminate them, but we can strengthen the immunity of our bodies. John Lee Anderson, writing in The New Yorker, reported that protesters jubilantly chanted, "The Germs want the fall of the regime." Let's talk about President Bashar Assad, an unlikely president, at least when he was growing up. The presidency was supposed to be handed to his brother, and he is an ophthalmologist. How has he worn power?
Well, I think when he initially came to power, there were high hopes that he would bring about reform. He had been educated and spent time in the United Kingdom, and there was a sense that there might be change and reform that would come with his presidency. It pretty quickly became apparent that no real meaningful reform was going to take place. And I think that the perception of President Assad, at least from many of the protesters and many of members of Syria's opposition, they jokingly refer to President Assad as the puppet. They don't really see him as a man who is in control of his country, in control of his military. They see him as a puppet of cronies of his father, who they believe are the ones actually pulling the strings and controlling what happens in the country.
And who would those cronies be? A certain sect, a certain class? Who do they think is really running the country?
Well, certainly they all belong to one sect, or primarily belong to one sect, which is the same sect as Bashar al-Assad and his father Hafez al-Assad. They're called Alawites. It's essentially an offshoot of Shia Islam. They are a minority in Syria, but have been running the country for more than 40 years now. Syria is primarily a Sunni Muslim country, but there are also a Christian minority and a Shiite minority and the Alawite minority. As well as some Druze and some Kurds.
And though it is an oppressive police state, I have read that it is not the kind of country that perhaps where the sects are at each other's throats necessarily. Is that true?
That is true. I mean, I've been visiting Damascus and Syria for many years now because I used to live in Beirut, and Damascus is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And certainly when I went to visit long before any of these problems began, there was always a sense of tension and repression in Syria. There was always a sense that you had to be very careful about what you talked about in public. Certainly I never would have admitted to being a journalist. I would never ask people deliberately or overtly political questions that might make them feel uncomfortable. But because you had a minority ruling a majority, they did not use the narrative of sectarian bonds, so to speak, in order to further their political objectives. They relied on other ideology, nationalism, Arab nationalism, socialism, etc. So, yes, you didn't feel a strong separation between the various sects or any sense of rivalry between them. And it is very disturbing, as I saw on this last trip, to see these gaping wounds basically growing and growing between various sects.
Well, then what that tells me is that the ruling class, it wasn't in their interest to emphasize the sectarian differences, since they were a ruling minority, and therefore they should talk about pan-Arabism or some of the other ideals of the Ba'ath Party. They were just wielding power in the best way they saw fit.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And let's go back and let's talk about the father, Hafez al-Assad. You know, we sometimes forget just how cruel his regime was, but then we think about what happened in Hama and how he crushed dissent back in 1982. Tell us that story a bit.
Yes. Well, I mean, it was a terrible, brutal, unbelievable crackdown in the city of Hama, which is under attack once again now. It was a Sunni Muslim uprising in the city, and Hafez al-Assad sent in many tanks and many troops. And, you know, it's impossible to get an exact statistic or number of the dead because, of course, journalists were not allowed anywhere near the scene. But estimates are certainly in the tens of thousands. And I can tell you that having spoken to people on the ground in Homs and in Hama and other parts of the country, that there's a very real fear that after the shelling that has been going on, for example, in Homs, that ground forces will come into the cities and that there will be a slaughter. Now, there's no concrete reason to believe that will necessarily happen, but the level of fear, I think, gives you a sense of how fresh the wounds still are from Hama back under the time of Hafez al-Assad.
And the son, even though he was no more than a boy in 1982, did he take that lesson? Is that the lesson for Syrian leaders, how to crush a rebellion, is to do it swiftly and ruthlessly?
Well, that was certainly the message that his father propagated. I would say up until this uprising, there was no real sign or indication that Bashar al-Assad was going to follow in his father's footsteps. And I think it was very surprising to everyone how brutally and how quickly the regime crushed the very beginning protests, which were really just about a few teenage boys who had been arrested in Daraa for writing graffiti against the regime. And, you know, it was an unarmed, peaceful protest, and it was met with tear gas canisters, and very quickly tear gas canisters became bullets. And from there, it seemed to sort of spiral out of control to levels I don't think anyone quite expected.
There was an Arab Spring sweeping the entire region, not from an ethical or moral perspective, but do you think that initial overreaction was a tactical misstep? Would the regime admit that now?
I don't think the regime would ever admit it, but I think absolutely the ferocity and the brutality with which they cracked down on those initial protests. First of all, I think it belied some clear sense of insecurity and nervousness about the Arab Spring on their part. But there's no question that, in a sense, it exacerbated the situation, because immediately when you take things so quickly to the next level, so to speak, you're really whizzing right past the point of no return. And I think that the reason Syria has spiraled out of control so quickly is because of just that.
We're talking about the ongoing violence in Syria with CBS News reporter Clarissa Ward. You can join the conversation. What do you think the fight with Assad could mean for the Arab Spring? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Soon we'll be talking about Syria's neighbors. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the spreading violence in Syria, and you can join the conversation. Syrian Americans, what's your take on the violence? What are you hearing from Syria? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined this hour by CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward. Here she is on Friday, February 10th. Violence was flaring outside the cities of Homs and Aleppo, and Ward visited a mosque and a street demonstration in Idlib. Let's hear a little bit of her report.
Across Syria, Friday is a day for prayer and protest. As they emerged from the mosque, the faithful called out for God to help them win their freedom. Young boys led the chants. "We need a God-fearing president," this one cried. From their neighborhoods, they marched together into the main square, part of an area that locals call the free zone, where government forces have been pushed out. After days of fighting and mourning, today offered a rare moment of joy.
The rebels have managed to carve out this small enclave so that the people of this city can come out here without fear and celebrate what this uprising is really all about: freedom.
So there we hear Clarissa Ward saying this uprising is about freedom. We also hear the chant saying we need a God-fearing president in the United States and the West. There is fear of what the words God-fearing might be. How much credence, Clarissa Ward, should we put into nervousness of what is to come next? Is Assad, though devilish, the devil we know?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question, and I think one of the greatest obstacles that the opposition faces is that it has not been able to form a coherent, cohesive leadership structure with a clear message that is a message that is embraced by all the various facets of Syria's opposition. I know that there is a real sense of nervousness that this may become a hardline fundamentalist Sunni Muslim or that there may be an element of fundamentalist Islam to the opposition. In my experience on the ground, both in the city of Idlib and in the suburbs of Damascus. There were elements of that, but it was by no means the majority. And certainly there were other sectarian groups who were represented by people I met from the Alawite group, also from Christians. So I do think it's sensible to have a level of nervousness about the lack of cohesion and the lack of clarity. But I don't think that the fundamentalist Islamic element is something that should be given too much play.
And if the foreign policy question that's currently dominating the American discourse is what of Iran and its nuclear capability, a diplomat, a former Israeli diplomat writing in the New York Times, points out that the fall of Bashar al-Assad would mean good things for Israel's future. It would perhaps thwart the Iranian ambitions. Iran uses Syria as a conduit to get to Hezbollah. Those three are all allied. It doesn't seem that many people or enough people in the West are talking about this possibility, that the fall of Syria, were it to happen, would ally with a lot of American foreign interests right now. Do you think that's a decent take?
I mean, I think there's no question that the fall of Syria would deal a real blow to Iran and also, of course, to Hezbollah in Lebanon. But the question is, what comes in its place? What comes in place of Assad's regime? And there's a real fear that there may be chaos, there may be violence, there may be fundamentalist Islamic elements, and there's no real sense of, okay, these are the people who would clearly step in and navigate the country on a course to becoming a functioning democracy. So I think that's the real fear, and I think certainly if you look at a country like Israel, it's understandable that there may be an element, perhaps, of, well, maybe it is better the devil you know.
Maybe, but at some point you must also ask, how much worse could it be? Because Syria is a very oppressive country and a very bad actor in terms of Israel and United States foreign policy in that region. There's no arguing with that, is there?
Well, how many battles have there been on the Syrian-Israeli border? I mean, there's a lot of talk and there's a lot of rhetoric, but in very real, concrete military terms, I don't think Assad's regime has actually been too much of a headache for Israel.
That's true. Syria did essentially lose its wars with Israel and hasn't fought since then. Let's take a call. George is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. George, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
My question has to do with the Christians of Syria. I know that President Assad is a terrible man, but from a Christian standpoint, a lot of people stand behind him in Syria because of fear of what might happen, or Syria might turn into another Iraq. And we've all seen what's happened with the Christians of Iraq. I mean, even after the pullout, and it seems to be pretty stable now, the Christians are still leaving in droves.
Right.
And I just wanted to know what her thought was on, you know, on the Christians of Syria.
We'll put it to Clarissa Ward. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right. There is a lot of fear among the Christian community. The Christians make up about 10%, 10 to 12% of the population in Syria. It's not that I think that the Christian population is pro-Assad per se. I think that, as you pointed out, they're very nervous about what might come in their place, what might come in its place, rather. I must say that when I was in Damascus in November, and I spent a lot of time with activists, particularly young activists. And I met many, many Christians who were actively participating in this revolution and who felt that it was for the good of the country. But obviously, there needs to be a structure in place, or the opposition needs to put forward some kind of a sense of a joint plan or a vision for the country that will allow the Christians to feel that they're not going to be persecuted, that they don't have to fear for their very existence, because currently you're absolutely right. They have very real fears about what will happen.
Sam is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hello, Sam, and thank you for the call, George. But Sam, go ahead. You're on the line.
Hi, Mike. As usual, you know, NPR, I wish each and every one of us who has cable television will contribute one quarter of it. Things like this will come up and become democracy, free for all. People get their views. Mike, I was the one of the people who dissented when we invaded Iraq
mm-hmm.
for the same reason. the law of unintended consequences may apply here. Look at the geopolitical equation and the geographical location of Syria.
Right.
Some people are saying, well, this may be good for us and Israel. The fact is that the unknown, if the past is the indication of the future, one can see that we are running into a problem of making a type 1 or type 2 error. The problem is that nobody knows what's going to happen. If Syria goes into chaos, guess what? The neighbors from Jordan, Lebanon, Iran, even Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, you name it, will be given the common man there will be emboldened to say, okay, fine, next.
Right.
Well, now, what is the solution then? To leave the status quo now? Well, you know, what do you do is to look at the model of Jordan, where the king has gradually, methodically introducing reform in amicable, responsible, prudent way, you know, and we embrace him, and we, you know, he's our ally and our friends, and we talk with him and the people who are there and things.
Right, like. Right. So I get your point, Sam, and I'll talk about it with Clarissa Ward. Clarissa, are we past the point where we can even suppose that Syria could gradually reform? They had that chance. Bashar Assad had that chance for a decade, didn't he? And he didn't really make any sort of effort to move towards where the international community would want Syria to be.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, I think that door closed quite some time ago. I think definitely from talking to people on the ground and spending time there, too much blood has been shed for there to be any question of, going back to the negotiating table. And this is why, you know, Bashar al-Assad has talked about having a referendum this weekend and, making changes to the constitution so that there can be another election and
right.
blah, blah, blah. And it's simply, it's gone too far.
Right.
For
you,
the
could
people.
You could dissolve your cabinet and dissolve the parliament. But when those have no powers anyway, that's just window dressing.
Absolutely. And also, too much blood has been shed. And until you are out of the picture, Bashar al-Assad, if I'm speaking for, as the an oppositionist might, there can be no discussion.
Let's talk about some of the other neighbors, because Syria is so connected with so many world powers. Russia is a major benefactor and is supplying them with the weapons. The weapons, I heard, are hard to come by, unlike some parts of the Middle East. Kalashnikovs and AK-47s go for over $1,000, where they're under $200 in Iraq, or were at one point. What is the Russians' interest in Syria? Is it just a holdover from the Cold War?
I think part of it is certainly a holdover from the Cold War. Russia doesn't have many old Cold War allies in that part of the world. In fact, Syria is probably the lost. And Syria is its most important Arab ally. And then, of course, there are financial benefits for the Russians. The Syrians buy a lot of weapons for them. So it's in the Russian interest to try to maintain the status quo. I think perhaps the Russians are also hoping that they can have some kind of a role as a peace broker, if you will, between the two sides, because the reality is that everything we're hearing and learning and knowing from, whether it's reporting on the ground or talking to activists or talking to oppositionists, we have very little sense or very little access to the regime itself and what's going on in their minds and what their plans are. The Russians are one of the only countries in the world that really has any access to the regime and a good read on them.
And why did China join Russia in a veto of the UN resolution that perhaps would have gone far to addressing the violence?
Well, China, for its own political reasons, is very against the idea of a, regime change or the people power or overthrowing an oppressive regime. These are all things that petrify China. And so it makes perfect sense. And they also have, various financial benefits and agreements with the Syrian regime. So there's not really any incentive for them to come out against the regime.
But absent a UN decree, a no-fly zone, does the rebellion have a chance?
It's hard for me to see where the rebellion can go from here without some kind of support. It doesn't necessarily have to be immediate military support. It doesn't need to be an overnight sort of no-fly zone. But there needs to be at least some kind of a consensus from the international community that there, you know, that the people within Syria and those who support the opposition, that they have some kind of support. And that there is someone looking out for them. And then, you know, in more long-term sense, I think there has to be some kind of sense that there, you know, this support might manifest itself. Well, would there be, as John McCain talked about, would it be consist of giving weapons to the fighters? Would it consist of giving training to the fighters? Would it consist of, you know, having some kind of a no-fly zone? Or, but before we get anywhere close to that stage, I think at the very least, the rebels would like to feel that there's a sense that somebody is looking out for them. I know many of them said that it's impossible for them to really further things or think about pushing forward with military offensives until they have that underlying support from the international community.
I'm Mike Pesca, and this is On Point. So we've spoken of Russia, China. What about the two countries or two of the countries in the region that have recently had regime changes? First, Iraq, the other country, the only other country with a Ba'ath Party presidency. What does the collapse of Iraq mean for the rebellion?
The collapse of Iraq mean for the rebellion?
Well, the United States invasion and, yeah.
What does that mean for the rebels in Syria?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Well, I thought it was rather interesting when I was there. We were hearing, when I was in Iraq for many years, you would hear about Syrian suicide bombers coming across the border to help with the jihad, as they would call it. And now what's so interesting is that you actually have a reverse effect where you have Iraqi fighters coming through that border into Syria to help with the Syrian struggle or uprising. So I think that goes to show you how quickly the dynamics of change are in this region, this part of the world. We also heard of fighters coming in from Libya into Syria. But, you know, that also creates a potentially explosive situation when you have many other powers and many other countries getting involved in what is essentially a civil dispute. It's a recipe for disaster.
And as far as Libya, the situation, sure, there was part of the Arab Spring and Gaddafi was deposed. But militarily, the two countries are so different, right? Libya disorganized.
There's no comparison. And, yeah.
The Syrian military is a serious and forceful entity, yes?
The Syrian military is a much more sophisticated, well-equipped, well-armed, well-trained military than the Libyan army ever was. And even the geography of the country is such that it really is a completely different set of issues in terms of looking at a military approach to it.
Although I do hear and read that the rank and file of the Syrian military is mostly Sunni, as is the country, that would stand to reason. But the leadership are Alawites. And I know that after the current president was put into power, leaders of the military were changed to be closer aligned to him. Might that dynamic come into play?
Well, I think everybody is very curious to see how and when and if that dynamic may come into play. Certainly, I had heard a lot of rumors, and I must stress that they were rumors, but from people on the ground in Syria, that the reason you had not seen a large ground force being sent into Homs, the reason that it was largely shelling from tanks, was because if you sent a lot of ground troops into the city, perhaps many of them would not come back, that they would actually defect given the opportunity. And I can't possibly comment on those rumors, but I can tell you that I spoke to two mothers who lived in rebel strongholds, who were very much with the opposition, with the uprising, and both of their sons were in the military. And from their perspective, their sons are, you know, they're military conscripts. They don't choose to be there. And they really have a gun to their heads on both sides. You know, on the one hand, they support the revolution. They support the uprising. They have no desire to shoot on protesters. On the other hand, they have an officer, you know, telling them that if they don't shoot on these people, that they're going to be killed. So I do think at a certain point, it would not be surprising at all if we started to see more defections, particularly from the Sunni Muslim rank and file, the so-called grunts, if you will.
We are discussing the ongoing violence in Syria that could become a full-blown civil war. You can join the conversation. Can the rebels go the distance and out Assad? Will that require outside help? Should we give that help? What will the upheaval mean for the region? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the turmoil in Syria as the Arab Spring continues to shake the Middle East. And you can join the conversation. Was chaos in Syria an inevitable outcome from the Arab Spring? Could an opposition takeover in Syria be worse than the Assad regime? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us this hour is CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward, who recently did some reporting from the front lines for the battle for Syria. Let's hear some of that.
Men have just had word that the regime forces have surrounded some rebels. You can now hear on the loudspeaker they are calling people to come together and go and fight.
The Syrian Liberation Army set out to answer the call. With light weapons and heavy hearts, they stood guard on their street corners, brave defenders of their community, but no match for the Syrian army when it comes.
And there, Clarissa, there you are talking about the Syrian Liberation Army, which you referred to before. Just getting access to them, how trying was it?
Well, it's not so difficult to get in touch with them because they do have people in the U.S. and outside of Syria and Europe and various other countries who are actively trying to court the press, because obviously everybody wants to get their message out. Everybody wants to make sure that their group is known by the world. But there's a big leap between having a discussion with someone who's affiliated with one of these groups to actually getting into the country and spending time with one of these groups. I would have to say this is one of the most difficult and dangerous assignments I have ever covered, because President Bashar refuses, or his regime refuses, to issue for the most part any visas, journalism visas, to allow independent journalists to report from within the country. They have issued some, but it's certainly very difficult to get one.
And then when you do get one, you're beset by minders and they're dictating what you can and can't see. John Lee Anderson just has a 10-page article in The New Yorker. It just hit the presses. I bet you haven't had a chance to read it. But part of what he talks about, you know, you have to read between lines and finding out what the minders don't want you to see. But there he is sitting inside a home while the army is attacking the home next door. And John Lee Anderson calls the highest person he knows in the Syrian military and says, could you stop this? You might kill us. A few phone calls later, they're told, yeah, get out of there right now. But that's how dangerous it is. And we lost a great reporter in Anthony Shadid reporting from Syria just in the past week. Is reported that he died of an asthma attack. But still, it's a dangerous, dangerous place. And you say, you were quoted in the Times as saying, as dangerous and as tough an assignment as you've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, I think that from my experiences in Syria, both going in on a tourism visa and entering the country legally, the only way you really have access to move around and to do reporting without feeling that you're endangering the lives of others because you may be followed, et cetera, is to go in illegally, unfortunately. And obviously that brings with it a whole host of other issues. As you saw in the very tragic case of Anthony Shadid, you're very far away from having any kind of medical help or anything like that. You really, once you're in the country, you're extremely isolated. No internet, no cell phones. You're relying on satellite phones. Even then, the reception is very spotty. And you're relying on information from other people, things we take for granted as reporters. Normally, we wake up in the morning, we read the wires, we read all the newspaper articles. Well, when you're inside Syria, it's like an information vacuum. There is no information coming out. So you have to I described it as like putting together a puzzle every morning. You're trying to put together all the various little pieces of information that you have about what's been going on in your neighborhood and the area at large, and trying to form a coherent picture of what's going on and how you should behave accordingly, what's safe, what's not safe. So it really, in terms of on the reporting side, it's certainly the most challenging assignment I've ever had.
Right, because there are autocratic regimes, Myanmar, North Korea, very hard to report out of there. And then there are hot wars, you know, the Congo Civil War. But it's rare that you have the combination of the two, where there's live fire to have to watch out for, but also a fully functioning dictator state to stop your progress and free travel. It must be a horrible situation.
Absolutely. And there are, you know, even in these so-called free zones, as you heard in my report earlier, there are government checkpoints all around. And going through a government checkpoint, well, it's impossible, not just because of having an international journalist with you, but also all the people who we would be traveling with, are their names are on lists. And if they ever get stopped at a checkpoint, they will be detained immediately. So as you said, you can't really move around the country. And by the way, even the friendly checkpoints, which are run by other rebels, again, it's like they don't know which group you're from, and everybody gets upset and people are waving guns in your face, and someone has to get out of the car and say, no, these guys are okay. They're with these rebels. And so it's very dangerous.
And the consequence of all this, other than inconvenience or, to be frank, peril on the part of people such as yourself, is here's a quote from Mark Whitaker, who's an executive vice president of CNN International. If we could see as much of what is happening on the ground as we were able to see in Egypt and Libya, this would be leading the news broadcasts of all the networks almost every night. Is that an indictment of our industry in a way that without the pictures, the story gets pushed down?
I think it's an indictment of Bashar al-Assad's regime. They've made a very cynical calculation that by not allowing, or by very much curtailing and limiting access to international journalists to report independently from inside the country, that in some way would mean that the world would almost forget about it, because there's only a certain point up to which people can really assimilate this constant stream of numbers, 30 killed today, 30 killed yesterday, 30 killed, and, you know, just looking at these shaky YouTube clips. If you don't have reporters on the ground putting it all into context and also giving a real sense of the humanity of the situation, or the lack of humanity, I should say, then obviously it's very difficult for people to engage in a complex and convoluted story like the Syria story. So I think that American networks have a huge appetite, and I know that CBS is very committed to this story and is always wanting to put more pieces on air. But it, you know, the Syrian government has made it incredibly difficult to do so.
Right. In that same story where I quoted Mark Whitaker, you were there saying, I would hate to think that the Assad regime has been successful in their very cynical calculation that keeping journalists out of the country will mean the world forgets about the story. And my question about that quote, as true as it is the important thing or the critical thing in these Arab Spring stories that the world is aware, or that people within the country are actually aware of what's going on?
I think most people within Syria are very much aware of what's going on, because that is a country now where normal life literally does not exist. It's a country that's completely galvanized by this uprising and by the violence and by, you know, the sectarian divisions that are starting to emerge under the stress of the violence and of the events of the last year. I think it is extremely important for people around the world, and particularly in countries like the U.S., which has stretched a strong voice in the international community, to get a better understanding of what's going on in these countries. And I think it's important for anyone in the world to know when a regime is slaughtering its own people by the thousands in a way that I can't remember the last time in very recent history that we saw such a thing.
Musa is calling from New York City. Hello, Musa. You're on with Clarissa Ward of CBS.
Hello. How are you, Mike?
I'm well. Go right ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, my question is, I have a question. Also, it's almost like frustration. My question is really about the United Nations. I mean, it's over 50 years with a lot of experience in conflict, and yet they are not capable to put to take action quickly as possible. We see this regime last year to now with Gaddafi, more than 3,000 people die. The guy is flying over the people and killing them, yet they sat aside, talk. The same thing is going on with Syria. If the international community act yesterday or the last week, they will save more than 100 people. From last week to now, the people still dying. We see this with Gbagbo in Ivory Coast. People dying, and yet people sat aside, just talk. The same thing is going over, and the same kind of regime with Iraq, with Gaddafi, now with Syria.
Right. So the question, and thank you for the call, Musa, is this actually a case of the United Nations dithering? It's not just that they're talking. They talked, and the two member states with veto power said no, right, Clarissa?
Well, exactly. I mean, the UN depends on consensus, and Russia and China, with their veto power, made a consensus impossible. But I do think that it's more than that. Syria is a very complex picture, and it's not clear. There are many people around the world who are studying this very closely, who are trying to look at what the best way forward is. And there is not a clear and obvious way forward until there is a better sense of who the opposition are, who their leadership is. We know the Syrian National Council is the sort of most legitimate of the opposition bodies out there, but even within the SNC, as they call themselves, there's an enormous amount of infighting, and there isn't a real sense of clarity in terms of showing the international community about what the way forward is for Syria and for the opposition.
Well, Egypt is far from a functioning state. Libya, a head scratcher. But is the lesson there that if you pick the right horses to back, or if you're confident, and when I say you're speaking of a foreign country who thinks that they can influence affairs, if you're confident or at least okay with whoever's supposedly going to come into power next, that things will be fine? I mean, it seems that the lesson is no matter how much, contradict me, or if there is further evidence, different evidence, tell me. But it seems like the evidence that the information is no matter how much you think you know, you don't know. And you have to at some point almost surrender to that if you're a foreign nation who, you know, has the ideals of freedom and is anti-government oppression.
Yes, I think that the lesson is that the Middle East is probably one of the most complex regions in the world, and the way that we as Americans perhaps approach politics or ideas of democracy and freedom or of nation building is radically different to the way that they have traditionally approached these issues. And I think that there needs to be a sense, you know, of course, when you look at these uprisings and the initial inspiration of people standing up for themselves and standing up for freedom. And in many ways, that is, I hate to say it, but the easiest part. It's the part that comes afterwards. And many revolutionaries will tell you this from Egypt, from Libya, and from Syria. It's the part that comes afterwards when you have to rebuild a country almost from scratch. That's where the real political challenges lie.
I'm Mike Pesca. This is On Point. Omar is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Omar. You're on with Clarissa Ward.
Hi, Mr. Mike. Thank you for putting this issue on the table. And I came back from Syria in July. I had a lot of horrible stories happen over there. One of them was in Sakba area. Two brothers were in shock point. They were in checkpoint. After they released them, there was a changing of the checkpoint soldier. Mm-hmm. The new one came and started to call them again, but they did not listen to him, and they shoot them. When they came back to them and searched them, they found that they are a death. They are a death people. So the situation, other stories happened in Daraa also. One of the soldiers who did not come back to his family like for 3 months, he just wanted to check up on his family. He went to a grocery store, called his mother. His mother told him that one of your brothers died in protesting. So he came back to his unit and opened fire on all his officers. So, you know, I don't understand it. If you do not want to arm the pre-Syrian army, and you do not want to pass any resolution from the Security Council, that means you are let the people, the Syrian people, alone.
Omar, is your frustration that the West is not reporting this story enough or getting details wrong?
My frustration is just you have to find a solution, either to arm the Free Syrian Army, or you can by yourself and help me. And but to leave me like a hand tied and tell me just you have to be peaceful for the rest of your life, it's not going to happen. I mean, the people, like, you know, it's 11 months right now. One of my friends got arrested 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I have his picture with me. I mean, for no reason, just because he went out and said, I want my dignity and I want my freedom.
All right, Omar, we have to leave it there because I wanted to ask Clarissa Ward about what happens next. This could shake out in so many ways. What are some of the likely scenarios that you see, Clarissa?
I mean, there are so many possibilities, many of them rather grim. Of course, what everybody is talking about here is is the very real possibility of civil war. I think that one thing is very clear, that the longer this goes on, the longer the international community does not step in or provide some kind of support, the longer there isn't a consensus among the international community, and the longer that Bashar al-Assad's regime stays in power, the worse the problems are going to get. And I think, just touching on what Omar said, what's so important to remember is that it is civilians who are bearing the brunt of this conflict. They are the people who are so often being killed in cold blood simply because they are in the wrong place at the wrong time. And certainly, every option needs to be examined in order to try to help these people and stop this from happening.
Do you think it's likely or unlikely that in 2 years the Assad regime is still in place?
From a personal point of view, I think it is. I think that the Assad regime is doomed to topple, as I believe Ehud Barak said over the weekend. But I do believe his regime will fall. It's not a question of if, but when. The problem is that how many people have to die before that happens? And then, of course, a very important question of what happens afterwards. Who comes in his place? What kind of a government are we looking at? Are you going to see revenge killings like we've heard about in Libya? We've heard about Free Syrian Army people carrying out executions of so-called Shabiha or pro-Assad thugs who they capture. And I don't think anyone has an appetite for that sort of retaliatory violence.
Clarissa Ward, foreign correspondent for CBS News, one of a handful of Western reporters to independently report from Syria. Thank you so much for joining us for this hour.
Thank you, Mike.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. We also have a collection of Clarissa's reports up there, as well as maps of the region. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Mike Pesca, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.